Hi, this is Nyla in for Jen. Just a quick note before we start the show. The news is rapidly developing and things might have changed by the time you hear this episode. So for the latest news, tune into your public radio station and find updates at npr.org. This is the 1A Podcast. I'm Nyla Boodoo of Axios Today, in for Jen White, and you're listening to the News Roundup. COVID cases have jumped more than 30% in the last 2 weeks. As scientists warn, a wave of Omicron is almost inevitable. But what would a wave of Omicron even mean? We're learning more about the highly transmissible variant, but some say not enough. Meanwhile, recovery efforts continue in Kentucky and five other states after historic tornadoes tore through the South and Midwest. And a series of texts turns up the heat at a committee tasked with investigating the Capitol attack. Here to help us unpack it all is Anita Kumar. She's a senior editor for Standards and Ethics at Politico. Anita, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me back.
And Shane Harris covers national security and intelligence for The Washington Post. Shane, it's always a pleasure.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start out in Kentucky and go to Ryan Van Velzer in Louisville, where he's a reporter covering energy and the environment for WFPL News. Ryan, thank you for joining us again.
Thank you for having me.
When we spoke to you earlier this week, families were just starting to understand the extent of the damage. Where are things in the recovery effort for the thousands of people in Kentucky impacted by the tornadoes?
I have to say it is just overwhelming the amount of support that these Kentuckians have received from across the country. I think in just last weekend, Governor Andy Beshear immediately started up a relief fund. Already that fund has raised over $16 million, and that was as of yesterday. And that includes more than 93,000 individual donations. President Biden has ordered FEMA to cover 100% of the costs for the first 30 days for things like debris removal. That's huge for these communities. And I've heard that FEMA is already kind of going through these neighborhoods and helping people get individual assistance.
Which is so crucial. I know last time we spoke, utilities were still down for thousands of people, which includes water and power. Where does that stand now?
It's in a lot better situation than it was. There's still about 3,200 people or 3,200 connections still out, and 2,000 connections won't be restored for weeks. Those are mostly in the communities of Mayfield and Dawson Springs. There's almost no power system left there. The one bit of good news there is that Mayfield's water utility got its power back yesterday, which is important. And there's still probably around 18,000 people who are under a boil water advisory.
Unfortunately, criminal organizations and fraudulent groups often take advantage of people's generosity in the aftermath of storms. Is the state watching for that kind of behavior? Have you heard any reports of this?
There have been rumors of that going around. I think that I have not seen reports of that myself. I know that the governor and the attorney general have taken some steps, including some language regarding price gouging to prevent price gouging from happening. But I'm mostly extremely heartened by the way these communities have come together, way neighbors have come together, and the huge, huge volume of donations, not just money, but clothing, gifts, toys for Christmas that these communities are receiving.
And it's great to hear how much people have already given. For our listeners that want to contribute, how do you think they can best identify organizations that are engaged in the work on the ground?
Yeah, I think the two most important places to donate right now are the Team Western Kentucky Tornado Relief Fund, which I mentioned earlier, and you can just Google that. And similarly, the Western Kentucky Toy Drive, that's led by Governor Andy Beshear's wife, Brittany Beshear. And yesterday she said that that toy drive is now actually shifting from collecting toys to trying to delivering them, but they still need gift wrapping supplies, gift cards, books, art supplies, and technology gifts more related for or more appropriate for teens.
We're talking to Politico's Anita Kumar, Shane Harris of The Washington Post, and Ryan Van Velzer of WFPL News in Kentucky. Shane, Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas toured the damage caused by the tornadoes in Kentucky along with President Biden this week, and he said crews with FEMA will be on the ground until, quote, recovery is complete. Given our experience with previous natural disasters, what do you think that timeline is going to look like, as well as that commitment by FEMA?
Well,
And I think given the devastation that Ryan outlined here, we're talking potentially, you know, weeks, obviously, in the near term to get power restored, to get basic services back. But you're talking about rebuilding homes, I mean, essentially. So that's going to take quite some time. And I think what the administration is trying to do here is two things. Is one, signal the level of commitment. And basically, the president said, we will be here until it's finished. So he has essentially said that there's not, you know, a limit to that. And the second is really they've been trying to tie this to climate change and to point people to this event, which, I mean, we should be clear, you know, it's difficult to say this tornado is caused by climate change, but the climate is changing and severe weather is something that the administration has been trying to convey to people as a serious policy matter. We're going to talk later about, you know, the attempts to get a bill to address some of that through Congress. But Deanne Criswell, the FEMA administrator, came out in an interview and said, quote, this is going to be our new normal. So you really do see the president and his aides trying to condition people to this idea that you're going to have responses like this more often.
Well, it's great that you mentioned that. We actually have the full clip of her saying that. Let's take a listen.
This is going to be our new normal. And the effects that we're seeing from climate change are the crisis of our generation. We're taking a lot of efforts at FEMA to work with communities to help reduce the impacts that we're seeing from these severe weather events and help to develop system-wide projects that can help protect communities. And so we'll continue to work on helping to reduce the impacts, but we're also prepared to respond to any community that gets impacted by one of these severe events.
Again, that's Deanne Criswell, FEMA administrator, speaking to CNN earlier this week. Ryan, you had a story this week looking at the intersection of climate change science and tornadoes. Can you tell us more about the connections and where more research is needed?
Yes. I mean, the attribution science, the science of attributing a single event to climate change, especially with tornadoes, is particularly difficult. It's not as far along as it is with other events like hurricanes. And that's because tornadoes are really small, singular events, and it takes a combination of different weather patterns to make them happen. However, I think it's clear to me that climate change has played a role in this storm and will play a role in storms like it that happen in Kentucky in the coming months, or I'm sorry, in the coming decades. I had a chance to speak with Michael Mann, the climate scientist Michael Mann from Penn State, and he told me that, you know, there is a connection here with climate change, especially when it comes to warming temperatures. Kentucky doesn't usually see thunderstorms like this in December, and the thunderstorm came as a result of moisture coming up from the Gulf of Mexico. And of course, the Gulf of Mexico and actually the whole country right now is kind of in a warming spell, and we can expect warm winters to be warmer because of climate change. The weather that came here was in part because of a warming world. A second thing, two other important trends are happening in Kentucky in relation to tornadoes. The first is that storms like the one that Kentucky experienced with multiple tornadoes ravaging the state at the same time are becoming more and more frequent. Even though single tornadoes are happening less and less over time, we're seeing more of these tornado clusters happen over time. And worse yet for Kentucky, we're seeing that what is traditionally called Tornado Alley is actually moving north and east into western Kentucky.
We spoke earlier this week about the connections between climate change and extreme weather events. So you can head to 1A.org to hear more from that. Shane, I wonder, as we're talking about this and we think about the idea that some of these recovery efforts are under the purview of the Department of Homeland Security, are tornadoes being framed as a national security threat?
Well, I think, you know, FEMA sits under DHS, and this is absolutely FEMA's bailiwick. This is actually what they're historically very good at. There are notable exceptions that we remember, like Hurricane Katrina, where the failure was pretty systemic to respond to that. But the administration is framing climate change as a national security issue. The intelligence community came out recently with a big national intelligence estimate, sort of an overall comprehensive report that says that climate change is going to lead to more conflict, more competition globally over resources like water and food, more famines, more flooding, and that this is going to impact you know, countries and potentially lead to armed conflict as well. So they have really been trying to drive that idea. And I think when something this devastating happens, obviously it's a local event, but the administration is trying to more broadly frame climate as a global security issue and something that the U.S. has to respond to.
And Anita, these recovery efforts, as we've been talking about, not just in Kentucky, Minnesota, portions of the Midwest, can take months, if not years. And to Shane's point about FEMA's response, I think oftentimes people think of Hurricane Katrina and the political ramifications for that. How closely will President Biden's response be monitored and critiqued as we approach next November elections?
Yeah, I think that it will be monitored and critiqued. Presidents are always sort of looked at as, you know, these consoler in chiefs, right? We saw President Biden go take that trip there. We saw him hugging and talking to victims on the ground. And that was a moment, of course, but it's now these weeks and really months that people will be looking back on this. Now, there's so many other things going on. So there are going to be people judging him on COVID and immigration and the economy. It's not going to be the only thing, but I think you will see people, of course, those that are impacted, but others sort of looking to see how he did this. Of course, you know, as Shane mentioned, we famously remember the George W. Bush moment with Katrina. There are moments we think of. We think of President Trump and how he was on the ground during some of these natural disasters. So it will be something I think people will look at. But as you know, there's so much going on in the country right now. It's definitely not going to be the only thing.
We'll be back with more of the News Roundup. Remember, to join future conversations, download our 1A Vox Pop app and leave us a voicemail.
Support for NPR and the following message come from BetterHelp, offering online counseling. BetterHelp therapist Hesu Joe knows that lockdown has been hard on us as humans.
We as people are hardwired to connect with others, which is why this whole time is so difficult. The connection that happens between people can be very powerful, and how healing it can be to have a healthy relationship with someone.
To get matched with a counselor within 48 hours and save 10%, go to betterhelp.com/1A.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Capital One. Senior engineer Eric Mueller shares how his team uses machine learning to organize merchant names and transaction histories, and how this contributes to safer banking.
We take the merchant names, which might be in all caps, and they might even be wrong, and we use machine learning to clean them up. Having clean merchant names is important, really, to help you identify your transactions. So if you see a transaction you don't recognize, you'll know immediately it wasn't your transaction.
To learn more, go to CapitalOne.com/ML.
Over this last year and a half, the world's been through a lot. So on this season of the StoryCorps podcast, we'll hear stories reminding us that even when times are hard, we can still begin again. Listen to our new season wherever you get your podcasts.
We're rounding up some of the week's biggest headlines. Let's get back to the conversation. Let's get the latest on COVID and bring in Ruchana Pradhan. She's a correspondent with Kaiser Health News. Ruchana, welcome to 1A.
Thanks for having me.
We had a horrific reminder this week about the severity of this pandemic over the last couple of years. The U.S. reached 800,000 COVID deaths. Can you put that into context for us, how these numbers compare to past pandemics?
So I think it is a truly tragic milestone. I think the thing that really stands out for me is that most of the deaths in the U.S. from COVID-19 have occurred this year since vaccines were available. We have very ample supply of vaccines now, and yet we are still seeing deaths climb at an alarming rate. And I think all the signs are pointing toward this getting worse, given now the Omicron variant is circulating I think much more widely than we really know. I think the thing for me, what I'm really thinking about right now is that we still have a lot that we need to learn about this new variant. Of course, the Delta variant is still the dominant one as of right now in the U.S., and that's caused plenty of problems already. But I think we are still learning a lot about Omicron. Does it really cause more severe illness? Is it really milder, as some preliminary early data has shown? We have some indication about how well our existing vaccines protect against it. But what about our COVID tests? COVID test demand right now is going through the roof because it's holiday seasons and people are traveling. So I think it's a very scary time. And I think there was a great Washington Post story yesterday that I was reading that I think sort of underscores everyone's feeling about this. COVID fatigue is very real, and people are feeling kind of a sense of whiplash. How do you assess risk, and what do you really do right now to keep yourself safe?
And states like California are reinforcing mask mandates to prevent the spread of the Omicron variant. Dr. Anthony Fauci is continuing to emphasize the importance of getting boosted.
Omicron is going to be a challenge because it spreads very rapidly, and the vaccines that we use, the regular two-dose mRNA, don't do very well against infection itself.
Regina, what do we know right now about the effect that Omicron might be having on the U.S.?
So I think what is safe to say is that it seems like this variant is very transmissible. Cases are spiking. You referenced mask mandates. I think one thing that really stands out to me, I and all of us, I think, are based in the Washington, D.C. If you remember, the district undid its indoor mask mandate just before Thanksgiving, even though I think it's not a shock what happened, in light of that. Because Omicron is circulating, we are seeing a huge spike in cases. I think yesterday the district reported its highest single day total of new cases over the entirety of the pandemic. And this is with people vaccinated. So I think that Dr. Fauci has talked about boosters. It is true that it seems like boosters are highly protective against this variant. But the bad news is only about 17% of the U.S. population to date has received a booster shot. So the pace is really considerably, I think, going to have to pick up in order for this to get a handle on it, in addition to some of these other mitigation measures that we have all, I think, had plenty of experience with to date.
Right. And so what advice or other advice do experts have for protecting ourselves, especially as we're thinking about heading into the holidays?
Oh, so I think one of the things that people are saying, they're saying mask up, use tests. Of course, all of these things are potentially easier said than done. I think with masks, the thing that's really tricky is some states have decided to reimpose some sort of mask mandate in indoor places. But I think the combination of political will and just COVID fatigue, I don't think we're likely to see a rash of new ones in a widespread way across the country. Like I just mentioned what happened in D.C., and cases are going up. So I think there's that. There's the ability to test ourselves for COVID. There's been a huge emphasis, and the Biden administration has caught, I think, a good amount of flack for this in recent days about how rapid COVID tests are so hard to come by because of just widespread access and market availability, but also the cost. And those are really effective in making sure that we can stay safe because they work in detecting the virus, and also you can act quickly enough on the results. But people are still having trouble finding them, and they're not exactly the most affordable. So I think it's safe to say that it looks like we're headed for another brutal winter, unfortunately, and it's going to be difficult.
Anita, what is the Biden administration's plan to keep us safe? What are they saying, particularly when we're talking about testing and the availability of that?
Well, I think the first thing that they're saying is the thing they've been saying for, a year now or almost a year, which is get vaccinated. Obviously, they're talking about the booster, too. But really, this goes back to a real frustration by the administration that people are not getting vaccinated. You hear the president and others talk about how this is impacting those that aren't vaccinated, right? That, of course, people that have been vaccinated are getting COVID, where I'm not saying that, and they're not saying that, but the repercussions, the serious situation is with those who aren't vaccinated. So I think you will continue to hear them talk about that every single day. Please get vaccinated, because we're not going to get out of this until people do that. You know, there are other things that they're looking at. I think as we just talked about, there was criticism about the tests. They say that they will make more tests available. It's true, they're hard to come by. They are expensive, and that's something that they're looking at. You know, President Biden just talked about ordering enough of this Pfizer COVID oral vaccine to treat 10 million Americans when that's ready, after the company reported that the drug reduced the risk of hospitalization and death by 89% in the study of high-risk adults. So I think that there are other things, but you're going to hear them, number one, talk about the unvaccinated need to get vaccinated.
Well, even when it comes to vaccinated people, professional sports are being rocked by COVID. The NFL reported around 100 positive cases after last weekend. Here's NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell on Wednesday.
I think it calls for modifications to our protocols in general, and we're working with the Players Association on that.
It's not just football. Over at the NBA, the Chicago Bulls were forced to postpone both of their games this week because of COVID. It's the first time that's happened this season. Shane, we're thinking about the fact 97% of NBA players, 94% of NFL players are vaccinated. Do we know what's behind these outbreaks?
It's not entirely clear to me, and I was actually talking to some colleagues who pay closer attention to sports than I do. And it appears that, you have, obviously, people in congregate settings. I mean, they are athletes. They're in locker rooms together. They're playing together. As you said, many of them are vaccinated. I don't know that there's been any very serious illness or hospitalization among many of them. So in that sense, I guess the vaccines are doing their job. But what's been notable to me, too, about how the leagues have responded to this is that you did see early in the pandemic, some of the sports leagues, I think the NBA got a lot of credit for this, of having pretty sophisticated protocols kind of out of the gate, which gave you a sense that they had experts advising them they were going to try and control this thing. And you're seeing them adapt to this as we go, which is kind of illustrative of how we're all trying to deal with this, right? We've had now 2 years of experience with this. And every time a variant comes along, we have to look at it and adjust and move accordingly. But it is a pretty alarming thing when suddenly all of these people who are vaccinated seem to be, you see the effects of what happens when they're taken out, certainly on the games, but also at raises questions about people feeling, I'm sure, like, well, I am vaccinated too. Am I at risk of getting it? And yeah, you might. You also probably won't die.
Rachana, has the NFL changed procedures in the past week or given everything that's happened?
They have. I think what's really interesting, now some of these things are only looking like they're going to be temporary, but for example, the NBA temporarily is going to impose kind of an increased testing requirement. So that's interesting. I think, and then the other protocols have been changed to have stricter mask wearing in locker rooms and certain indoor settings, reimposing social distancing requirements, and also imposing some restrictions on outside activities. One of the things that I was reading this week that really struck me, actually, was that Dr. Alan Sills, earlier this week, the NFL's chief medical officer, was saying that 2/3 of the players with positive tests were asymptomatic and others had mild symptoms. So you may not even get a test. Certainly if you're not showing symptoms, a lot of people won't even go to the trouble to test themselves. So I think that does underscore what's really happening here. And I think everyone's threshold for risk is different, right? I think a lot of public health experts have underscored that at this point in the pandemic, or really our expectations for vaccines, it's not realistic to expect that vaccines are going to prevent all infection. And I think given what we're seeing right now, without a doubt, people who have two vaccine doses currently considered fully vaccinated, and even maybe some people with boosters, are getting infected and spreading this to other people. But I think the most important thing, of course, is like Shane mentioned, we still have a lot of protection if you are vaccinated against the worst outcomes of this disease.
One more thing I wanted to talk about with this. Supply chain holdups are creating shortages of everything from cream cheese to Christmas presents, but they're also hitting hospitals. Hospitals are reporting that supplies like syringes, gloves, and catheters are running low, and restocking has been tough. Rachana, what does this mean for hospitals that are already dealing with surging COVID cases?
I think it's definitely a problem that none of them want to be having, to be clear. You don't want to be scrambling for basic supplies that, frankly, all patients need, regardless of whether you have COVID or not. Because it's just another consequence of the global supply chain crisis and port backlogs and lack of drivers to transport goods. And now it's affecting really basic things like I've reported on this not too long ago, and what was remarkable to me is there are these huge hospitals that have been holding donation drives to get crutches, for example, because there's a global strain on aluminum supplies. So, you know, they're having to ask their local communities to please donate gently used adult crutches because they're having a tough time getting them. I think the list of items is so large, I couldn't believe it when I was talking to quite major health systems, you know, that have, these aren't your typical, you know, small rural hospitals. These guys are, these are pretty large and dominant health systems in their respective locations with multiple facilities. And they were saying that they're having to go to such great lengths to secure enough quantities of syringes and needles and gauze and tape and just really basic stuff that, frankly, I think a bunch of us take for granted when, you know, if we have to go to the hospital. So it's definitely another strain on things, and it's very unwelcome given the surges that we're seeing right now.
We just got a tweet from Aaron who asked, at what point will case numbers stop mattering? Because it's clear that this can infect vaccinated people. The case numbers are seemingly never going to fully decline. When does it just become about not overrunning the hospitals? Shane?
I think arguably it is about that now. And you could even maybe say it's always been about that. Obviously, preventing serious illness and death is a primary concern. But from the beginning, you have heard public health officials say that a major concern as well is making sure that the hospitals are not overrun. So if we take the example here in the District of Columbia, where, of course, as we mentioned earlier, the mayor lifted a mask mandate, which was surprising to some people given the case surges. What she noted also at the time were the rates of hospitalization, and essentially saying we need to also look at this metric of how is the healthcare system coping with this. The virus is going to be here for a long time. It is going to enter an endemic phase. People are going to get it every year, the way they get flu, the way they get other seasonal viruses. So I think what you're seeing now, and Omicron is scary because it's new and it's transmissible, but this conversation is moving with public health officials towards thinking not so much about just case numbers, but about the severity of those cases and the strain on the hospital system. That's a tougher, more nuanced conversation to have, I think, when people are still very frightened of catching this virus.
Let's move on to one other health story. Yesterday, the FDA announced it would relax controversial restrictions on access to an abortion pill by mail. The drug, called mifepristone, is used to terminate pregnancies up to 10 weeks. And according to the CDC, the medication was used in at least 42% of all abortions in 2019. Anita, as we think about this, first, I wonder if you can just tell us, we've got 19 states concentrated in the South and the Midwest that already had a ban on telemedicine visits for medication abortion. Do we know what further action we can expect to see from states now that the federal restrictions have been lifted?
Yeah, I think you're going to see states act, and you see this, you know, on different issues, abortion included, that states are sort of reacting after the fact, but they also are reacting before, you know, in anticipation of a decision. So prior to this, before this year, we saw states ban the mailing of pills, ban, you know, passing laws requiring pills to be obtained in person. Four states passed laws to set the limit on medication abortion at earlier than 10 weeks. So you're seeing, you're going to see states push back on this. You're going to see, you know, Democratic states, sort of blue states, welcoming this. And so we're going to continue to see sort of these conservative states react. And of course, this is all, while this is a big move and you have a lot of people talking about it, this is sort of setting the stage for the Supreme Court decision on abortion in general, which we expect, you know, in June or maybe sometime earlier.
We're rounding up some of the week's biggest news. A reminder to have your questions answered on future topics or just to let us know what you think, tweet us at 1A. We'll be back with more after the break.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Best Fiends. When it comes to match three style puzzle games, only one reigns supreme, Best Fiends. It's an action-packed adventure game and puzzle game rolled into one, so it's no wonder it's got so many five-star reviews. Plus, there's new content added all the time.
If you're tired of crushing the same old candy, give Best Fiends a try. You can download Best Fiends free on the App Store or Google Play Store. That's friends without the R. Best Fiends.
Over this last year and a half, the world's been through a lot. So on this season of the StoryCorps podcast, we'll hear stories reminding us that even when times are hard, we can still begin again. Listen to our new season wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to the News Roundup. Let's get back to the conversation. Let's turn now to the Federal Reserve. After a two-day policy meeting this week, the central bank announced it would phase out its large-scale bond-buying program. That means the Fed could raise interest rates sooner rather than later. Anita, what does this mean exactly from a consumer standpoint?
Yeah, so this was a little bit of a change, right? You know, the Federal Reserve is trying to basically curtail inflation. As people know, they have seen record high prices on all sorts of goods everywhere that you're trying to buy. The prices of things have gone up, and what they're trying to do is curtail those price increases, that inflation, but they don't want to disrupt the recovery, the economic recovery. And, you know, as we've just been talking about, the COVID spikes driven by this new variant and other these higher cases are threatening to slow down the economy once again. So they're trying to strike this balancing act. And what the Federal Reserve is saying after saying they wouldn't change interest rates is that they are forecasting 3 rate increases next year as soon as March.
Shane, as Anita was mentioning, in November, we saw inflation hit its highest level in 4 decades. How do these recent moves by the Fed tie into a larger strategy to curb inflation?
Well, I think that you've seen the chairman, Jerome Powell, move pretty quickly, especially now after he's been reappointed. Look, the administration understands inflation is a big problem, both politically, but more to the point for people's bottom lines. And we've talked on the show before about the factors that have gone into that, particularly the supply chains and just the huge demand that people have for goods. So, you know, this is historically controlling inflation, setting policy that tries to manage unemployment, get the economy to a full employment level. This is what the Fed does. So this is what is in their toolkit. And I think the fact that you see Jerome Powell reaching into that now and trying to move quickly, you know, is a signal that they realize that inflation has gone on longer than they would like. I think probably longer than some economists had forecast. So it's a real concern. He stressed that the underlying fundamentals in the economy are strong. There is growth. There's maybe too much growth. That may be part of the problem. So this is really, you know, Fed policymakers doing what they do and stepping in to try and curtail this before it gets persistently high for too long.
President Biden's approval ratings took another hit this week. A recent CNBC All-America Economic Survey shows 37% of Americans approve of his handling of the economy, 56% disapprove. Anita, that's a 3-point drop in approval since last quarter. Is what we've all been talking about behind these numbers, or is there something else?
Yeah, I think there's, you know, there's the economy, there's the failure in some cases to get some things done that he had said he would do. Now, you can't fault him completely for that. We've got Congress that, you know, is failing to push through some of his agenda items. And of course, we have COVID. So it's a variety of things. I think, you know, there's a source of frustration by administration officials and Democrats who say, look, this president has actually gotten some things done, you know, and we sort of forget some of those things. He did push through this coronavirus relief bill. He did have the infrastructure bill that's been pushed through. Some of those things are, or those things are really huge amounts of money, resources going across the country. But what we continue to see is sort of this COVID fatigue, worry about inflation and these high prices and the economy and how he's working on that. And so, you know, there are Democrats that are really concerned about what this is going to look like next year as we get into a midterm year. Of course, this is a lifetime. A year is a long, long time before the elections, and a lot of things can change. But there is worry in the Democratic Party about this.
Well, let's talk about Congress and let's talk about legislation. And once again, the Build Back Better plan is in congressional limbo. Shane, what's happening here?
It all comes down to a senator we've talked a lot about in recent months, Joe Manchin. I mean, I think you can pretty much put it down to this, that there is Democrats are unable to get consensus within their, you know, obviously evenly divided caucus here in the Senate to round support for pushing through this major plan, which is at $2+ trillion now. And Joe Manchin has largely been kind of the obstacle to that, of objecting to the scope and the size of it. And what you're seeing now, notably, is, I think, a signal from the administration that they realize they're probably not going to get this bill passed by the end of the year. And now there's talk of trying to quickly switch to voting rights legislation, which is another big priority for Democrats. So, you know, yet again, we have this situation where within the party, there is not agreement on the size and the scope of spending, what the government should be putting its resources towards. The backdrop of this is inflation. The pandemic is still happening. Some Democrats, like Manchin, questioning, why are we throwing all this money in? Will that have an inflationary pressure? For the president who ran on being the great negotiator and being a senator and somebody who understood how this process worked, I think it shows you, you know, that how difficult managing this legislation actually is. But this doesn't work well for him politically when he, you know, the pitch that he made to the American people was, I am the guy who knows how to do this. Well, okay, then why hasn't the bill passed? And that's a political challenge for this White House, no doubt.
Anita, is it clear what Democratic Senator Joe Manchin wants?
Well, we've heard a few different things. I mean, what the Democrats essentially did with what their sort of compromise is now, the current bill, is they took a lot of different things and just kind of reduced the amount of money they're spending on it, or the amount of time that it will, this benefit would be around. Think, you know, some of the things that Joe Manchin wanted were to actually eliminate some of the programs in there. We've heard that he doesn't like the amount, so the total amount, right? It's a little bit bigger than he wants. We also know that he doesn't like certain things in it. So he has talked about the child care tax credit and how he does, you know, perhaps doesn't want that in there. We've heard about paid leave, which actually was stripped out and then the House put it back in. We've heard about how he doesn't want some of these climate issues in there. So there are a variety of things. And we have heard this week that, you know, there's some frustration between both sides that they're just sort of not getting anywhere. You know, the White House is really pushing back and saying, look, we're not saying this is over. We're not even calling it a pause. What we're saying is, it might take, and I think the president said this in his statement, days or weeks. What that means, though, is essentially they're saying it's not going to happen by Christmas, which is fast approaching, and that it's going to take longer.
Shane, you were talking about voting rights a minute ago. Some Democrats on the Hill are saying that if Build Back Better is stalled, they want to turn their attention to election reform. And in fact, Democratic Senator Raphael Warnock of Georgia led that charge on Tuesday.
What about bipartisanship? Isn't that important? I say, of course it is. But here's the thing we must remember. Slavery was bipartisan. Jim Crow segregation was bipartisan. The refusal of women's suffrage was bipartisan. The denial of the basic dignity of members of the LGBTQ community has long been bipartisan. The three-fifths compromise was the creation of a putative national unity at the expense of Black people's basic humanity. So when colleagues in this chamber talk to me about bipartisanship, which I believe in, I just have to ask, at whose expense?
Anita, do you think we'll see meaningful movement on voting rights reform before the end of the year?
Oh, that's a tough one. I think they've got the same problem that the Democrats have, the same problem they had on this Build Back Better agenda, the president's agenda, which is, you know, they are facing a situation where they really will have to change the rules, right? Get rid of the filibuster in some fashion to pass this bill. So meaning allowing this to go through with a majority as opposed to this 60 vote threshold. And what we're seeing again is that this week we heard that Joe Manchin, who we just mentioned, and Kyrsten Sinema, another moderate senator, while they support the bill, this voting rights bill that we're talking about, they don't support changing the rules. And so herein lies the problem that, you know, Democrats as a party support this, but they don't support the mechanism to get it through. Republicans aren't supportive, and so they're once again stuck.
Shane, can I ask you one quick question about this? Because in his speech, Raphael Warnock suggested that if the Senate changed filibuster rules for the debt ceiling, it could do that for voting rights reform. Is that accurate?
There's been talk about whether you could do sort of a one-off change to the rules, yes, through for voting rights reform. I think that practically speaking, Senator Manchin and Senator Sinema probably would be an obstacle to that. But there is talk of trying to do something in the rules to let this one kind of to get through. But I don't think that's become clear yet precisely how they would do it or overcome those fundamental objections.
The insurrection was nearly a year ago, but January 6th is still making news. This week, the House voted to hold former White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows in criminal contempt. The former congressman from North Carolina refused to testify before the committee. Anita, what does this mean? What power does Congress have when it comes to alleged crimes?
Well, so this is unusual because he's, according to congressional aides, the first former member of Congress. As you remember, he was a member of Congress from North Carolina to be held in contempt of the body he once served in 200 years. So this does not happen often. It does not happen to a former member of Congress. What they can do is recommend basically that he'll be charged. If you recall, not too long ago, they made the same recommendation about Steve Bannon, who was once a White House aide, but then was not most recently, but obviously is close to former President Donald Trump. And he was indicted by a federal grand jury after the House voted for that recommendation that he be found in contempt for refusing to cooperate with the committee. So we could see that perhaps again. What's been unusual to see about Mark Meadows is that a couple things. One, I guess he was much closer to Donald Trump. He was in the White House. He was the last chief of staff. So he was privy to all sorts of things that were going on in those final days. But also, he did cooperate in some fashion. And that has been interesting to sort of see. He did turn over thousands of documents and texts and other things that the committee now has an idea of what was going on. But his argument is that he's not allowed to turn over more. He's not allowed to cooperate and talk because former President Donald Trump says this is part of executive privilege. And he's asking a court basically to say what he can and cannot do.
And of course, this came after a lot of news after the Select House Committee came out. A lot of news this week out of this committee. Mark Meadows' text messages reveal that several prominent Fox News hosts were in contact with him that day. Shane, what were they texting Meadows?
They were texting him, "You have to urge the president to come out and tell these supporters of yours who are storming the Capitol to stop," framing it as, "This is getting out of hand. You are about to destroy everything that you've worked for. This will be your legacy." It was striking, I mean, to see people who are pretty much, you know, unreserved supporters of the president to be privately trying to channel to the chief of staff that this was a huge threat, not just politically, but what was actually happening at the Capitol, and that he had to do something. And of course, you know, ultimately, President Trump did come out and make a statement much later in the day. But we all remember that he praised the protesters who were there. It felt very half-hearted, I think, to a lot of people, and probably people who were urging him to come out and say something. So you really get a window with these text messages of behind the scenes how alarmed the president's most ardent supporters were and felt that he had to personally step in and take control of that situation.
And not just people in media. Republican lawmaker Jim Jordan was also texting Mark Meadows. Anita, what was the Ohio congressman saying?
Yeah, and of course, Jim Jordan is a very staunch supporter, ally of President Trump. He had sent a message on January 5th, so the day before the attack, sort of forwarding a legal theory that Mike Pence, of course, then the vice president, did have the authority to stop the certification of the 2020 election. So if you'll remember, President Trump was very much pressuring the vice president, Mike Pence, to not certify the election. And Mike Pence said at the time he didn't feel like he had the authority to stop that, that he presides over he was presiding over Congress then, and he was, but he felt that he couldn't do that. And so, you know, a spokesperson for Jordan said that he did forward this text message to Mark Meadows, and it was sent to him by a former Defense Department inspector general that it basically was saying that Mike Pence had the constitutional authority to object to the certification and stop, essentially stop Joe Biden from becoming the president.
Of course, not every Republican has fallen in line when it comes to the attack on the Capitol. Wyoming Congressman and known Trump adversary Liz Cheney has taken a prominent role on the House Select Committee. She had this to say about the text.
Mr. Meadows' testimony will bear on another key question before this committee. Did Donald Trump, through action or inaction, corruptly seek to obstruct or impede Congress's official proceedings to count electoral votes?
Shane, I imagine this is not the last we will hear of this topic for this year.
That's right. And she's pointing to an actual criminal statute in the U.S. code that it's a felony. So she's raising the question of whether President Trump might have violated a specific law by what he did, which is why that. And she repeated that comment to let anybody think that it was a casual one.
Thank you to Shane Harris, who covers national security and intelligence for The Washington Post, and Anita Kumar, senior editor for Standards and Ethics at Politico. 1A's audio engineer and sound designer is Mike Kidd. He gets technical assistance from Adrian Danhauser. Aileen Humphreys is the producer and editor of 1A On Demand. Chris Castano is our digital editor. You're listening to the News Roundup. We'll discuss the week's biggest headlines from around the world in just a moment. This is 1A.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Kay Buxbaum in support of the David Gilkey and Zabiula Tamana Memorial Fund, established to strengthen NPR's commitment to training and protecting journalists in high-risk environments. Support for NPR comes from Newman's Own Foundation, working to nourish the common good by donating all profits from Newman's Own food products to charitable organizations that seek to make the world a better place. More information is available at newmansownfoundation.org.
There's a lot to get to, but before we dive headlong into the biggest stories from overseas, one quick positive update on a story that dates back to October. It's now been confirmed that the 12 remaining members of a group of American missionaries kidnapped in Haiti have been released. That news came from their Ohio-based charity and the Haitian National Police on Thursday. Joining us this week to guide us through the other top stories is Jennifer Williams. She's a deputy editor at Foreign Policy and host of the podcast The Negotiators. Welcome back, Jen.
Pleasure to be here.
Also with us is Greg Myrie, NPR's national security correspondent and author of This Burning Land, Lessons from the Front Lines of the Transformed Israeli-Palestinian Conflict. Hi, Greg.
Hi, Nyla.
And David Rennie is Beijing bureau chief for The Economist. David, thank you for staying up late with us.
Hello.
Let's start with some numbers from overseas, ones that might act as a warning about what we can expect to see here in the new year. On Wednesday, the UK posted a new record for the number of people testing positive for COVID in a day, 78,000. On Thursday, another new daily record, 88,000. Those numbers will get worse, according to the British Prime Minister, who addressed the nation on Sunday evening.
No one should be in any doubt. There is a tidal wave of Omicron coming. And I'm afraid it is now clear that two doses of vaccine are simply not enough to give the level of protection we all need.
David, Boris Johnson politically is in a ton of trouble with his own party and the rest of the country. What has he said about trying to find a way through this latest surge?
He's got to tread a path which in some ways is a real warning for American politicians because they're trying to tread a somewhat similar path. I mean, the UK isn't identical to America, but this is a country that has had a ton of cases, that has a pretty high full vaccination rate that's a little bit higher than America's, but not much higher, and has access to lots and lots of good vaccines. And yet it's getting absolutely thumped by this Omicron variant that was first spotted in South Africa a few weeks ago. And we're seeing case numbers doubling every couple of days. You mentioned the 80,000 figure, but in fact, we had the health secretary saying that the estimates are that it's probably around 200,000 infections a day by the middle of December. And if that doubles just a couple more times, you're going to be running at a million a day. We've got studies saying that it could peak in late January. Between now and May, there could be 30 million cases of this in the UK. And like plenty of American politicians, Boris Johnson is trying to straddle a party and voters, some of whom are very against the idea of governments telling people to have vaccine passports or certificates. They're very against mask mandates. So he's trying to hold together a kind of conservative party that is against government telling people what to do with a country that is clearly being absolutely sideswiped by this new Omicron variant. One of the good pieces of news coming out the last few hours is that The UK has good scientists, good public health scientists, who are working flat out to try and get some data out of the first cases. We've just had some news of an Imperial College London study just looking at the first couple of weeks of cases in the UK. And they're saying, so as the Prime Minister said, two doses really doesn't seem to give you a lot of effective coverage against simply getting the virus. But a booster does help. So if you get a booster, that third shot, it's between 55 and 80% effective. And there's a lot of attention about this, clearly very easy to catch, but how much severe illness does it bring? Does it send people to hospital at a much higher rate than Delta? And for the moment, it doesn't seem to be much more severe than Delta. So you're seeing the government wavering about mask mandates and pushing that third booster. The plan is to get everyone over 18 a booster by the end of the year, if they can possibly manage. And we're seeing huge queues outside vaccine clinics in the UK. And anecdotally, I can tell you, colleagues, family, people are going down with this all over the place in the UK.
Mm-hmm. Chris Whitty is England's chief medical officer, and he told reporters that scientists are around the world are still trying to get a complete picture of Omicron, but
all the things that we do know are bad, and the principal one being the speed at which this is moving. It is moving at an absolutely phenomenal pace, and therefore between the time that it first starts to really take off in a way people will be able to see and the point when we get to very, very, very large numbers will be quite a short one. And that, I think, is part of the issue.
So lots of things they're paying attention to in the UK. Jen, we've seen some of the earlier travel bans imposed on southern Africa lifted. What can you tell us about how parts of Europe are responding to this latest threat?
Yeah, so the biggest one so far was France's big announcement on Thursday that it would be tightening entry rules for people coming from the UK. So starting on Saturday, most travelers who are not either French residents or citizens have to give what they're calling a compelling reason to be able to enter the country. So vacation and work-related travel is banned. French and EU nationals and, you know, residents are exempt, but all arrivals will still have to provide a negative COVID test, less than 24 hours old, and then isolate for at least 2 days. So that's kind of one of the biggest travel bans we've seen recently in Europe that's really kind of causing a lot of drama and a lot of kind of tension right before the holiday season, right? When everyone's getting ready to travel. I think a lot of people were really excited to get to maybe travel for the holidays in a way that they couldn't last year when we thought COVID was at its peak. Silly us. But the other kind of broader thing that's happening in the EU, so EU leaders met in Brussels for a summit on Thursday specifically to talk about how to deal with this kind of latest surge. And their biggest concern beyond dealing with COVID, they're also trying to balance the issue of keeping borders open and making sure that the EU presents, you know, common policies, presents a united front. They said that they wanted to try to maintain the European solution. They want to make sure countries don't start going it alone. They also agreed to exercise this option to buy additional doses of the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine that is specifically adapted for the Omicron variant. Now, it's not actually ready yet. They have a prototype in development. They said they could. The company said they could have it ready in March. But I think in general, we are seeing the EU kind of trying to walk this really fine line between, you know, wanting to have, you know, very strict and, you know, appropriate measures in place for health restrictions, but also wanting to make sure that it's a united front that they're putting up.
Greg, according to CNN, nearly 1 year into the EU's vaccination campaign, 1 in 3 Europeans are still unvaccinated. Of course, we have millions of Americans who are also refusing to get the shot. To what extent does that leave any government short of options about how to fight back here?
Oh, it absolutely creates problems. I mean, you could see certainly in this country, which is getting Omicron, but has not had it full force, as some of these European countries have, you can just see a reignition or an intensification of the debate we're having. If we get we're already seeing a surge in COVID cases in general, but if we hit this real spike, are businesses and schools and restaurants going to shut down piecemeal, or will we see COVID mandates? This has all, you know, obviously been a huge battle going on for months already, and we may hit it even harder this time as the cases shoot up. I think a very important point to note here in the U.S. is that when we saw the original strain of COVID, it took a couple months for it to hit the U.S. with full force. When Delta was first detected in India. It took several months to come here. Now the Omicron variant, which was just detected in South Africa at the end of last month, less than a month, and it's already here. Again, not hitting yet at the wave that it has hit in some European countries, but every expectation is that it's coming with full force.
Jen, EU leaders have been talking in public about imposing a vaccine mandate on all EU citizens, but there's concerns growing over an increasingly violent pushback against COVID-19 vaccination plans. And on Wednesday, the police in Germany foiled a plot by anti-vaccination activists to murder a state premier in Saxony. What more do we know about this?
Yeah, this was a really kind of just stunningly disturbing case. So, as you said, this is an alleged plot by this kind of radical anti-vaccination group. They called itself the Dresden Offline Network, based in Dresden. And they had discussed on Telegram, on the messaging app, killing the state premier of Saxony, Michael Kretschmer. So he had been calling for a hard lockdown to break the fourth wave of infections. Saxony is among the lowest vaccinated rate in the country. It has the highest number of COVID infections in the country. And so, you know, he was calling for a mandate, calling for a bigger lockdown to break the kind of coming wave. So what's fascinating about this in particular is it actually wasn't originally foiled by the police. A German investigative TV magazine, ZDF Frontal 21, they first reported this. They did this kind of undercover investigation. They had an undercover journalist go inside the group and kind of watch what was going on. Then they revealed it, and the next day the police said they were investigating. So I think it's, you know, more broadly, it's a really disturbing sign of how, especially in Europe, but we've also seen in the U.S., you know, opposition to vaccines, to lockdowns, to even mask wearing is really becoming, and has been, but is getting even more violent. And I think it's really disturbing when we look around the country and around the world and realize that, you know, we may be done with COVID, you know, mask mandates and vaccines and get tired of it, but the virus is not finished with us. And I think it's really disturbing to see this kind of overt violence becoming, you know, an acceptable reaction.
As we catch our breath, we'll note the many tributes paid this week to Vicente Fernandez. Fernandez was an icon of traditional Mexican music, the last living legend of the Mexican ranchera. He sang about honor and courtship, cockfights and rodeos, love and heartbreak, all while dressed in the heavily embroidered costume of the charro, Mexico's chivalrous cowboy, with a full mariachi band never far away. Fernandez was 81 years old. Let's move on to South Korea, where officials are tightening restrictions in response to COVID-19 surges in that country. South Korean health officials announced this week that gatherings of five or more people are banned for at least the next 16 days. South Korea recorded a record number of COVID cases this week, with 7,850 infected. Along with the ban on large gatherings, venues, restaurants, gyms, and more will be closed. David, what has this surge looked like in South Korea, and how are the hospitals holding up?
Well, that's the key question. I mean, governments in every country have been dealing with this since COVID began, which is if you keep the controls on at maximum tightness all the time, then populations get exhausted. They start disobeying instructions. They just think there's no hope and you lose control of kind of public cooperation. And every government outside a kind of very, very strict dictatorship like China, where I'm sitting, basically needs voluntary cooperation from the public. But the flip side of that is that when you get a surge, because you have a wave of cases, and particularly now with Omicron, this very contagious variant, you have to try and keep the caseload within the number of cases that your hospital system can cope with, and particularly things like intensive care beds. It's not just that you need enough beds, but those are incredibly labor-intensive in terms of very skilled nurses and doctors who are just getting exhausted. So that was the kind of numbers that I think caused this new lockdown in Korea, which had about 6 weeks of trying to relax some of those very, very strict controls, because in Seoul, the capital, 87% of intensive care unit beds have been taken up. Across the whole country, it's running about 80% taken up. So they really don't have a tremendous amount of headroom, particularly elderly patients filling those beds because they're very severely ill. And so that is why you're seeing them going back to stricter controls after experimenting with a policy they had called living with COVID. And so it's this kind of slamming on the brakes, trying to let them off to give the population a bit of a breather. And unfortunately, with Omicron coming, you're seeing countries like Korea slamming on those brakes.
Jen, South Korea's vaccination rate, or full vaccination rate, is about 81%. Do we know how boosters are doing and what other factors might be behind the surge?
Yeah, so I think there are a few things here. One that's really interesting is, you know, we've been talking a lot about the Omicron variant, but the Delta variant is actually the dominant variant still in South Korea, and as it is very much in the U.S. as well. You know, we've had health experts warning that, yes, Omicron is coming, but we still need to worry about Delta. And so, yes, you know, more than 80% of the country, as you said, I think it's 81.5%, has received two doses, which is really, really high, right? It's only behind a few other countries. You know, in the U.S., I think we're at roughly 61%, at 69% in the U.K. But you have to understand that that's still, you know, if South Korea has, what, 52 million residents, that's still nearly 10 million people who are not fully vaccinated, right? So, you know, when you think of these big percentages of people, yes, but that still leaves millions who have not been vaccinated. And that's primarily where we're seeing a lot of these cases. But also, you know, the rollout of boosters has been, you know, kind of weird and rocky and slow in many countries, just because people are kind of trying to figure out, public health experts trying to figure out, you know, how to roll them out, who should get them, how much time should lapse between when you got your original shots before you get your booster. So South Korean authorities very recently, they did decide to accelerate that timetable for adults to get the booster shot. They knocked it down to 3 months from the time of your shot. It was previously a wait of around 5 months, I think. They've also said that teenagers now have to get vaccinated by February or face penalties. So we are seeing the response really focused on boosters and on vaccination. But again, it's looking like just that alone is not going to do it, because we're still seeing vaccine hesitancy in many places. And so that's why the government is going back to these kind of harder restrictions on businesses and private gatherings.
This week, the World Health Organization gave more updates on the effort to vaccinate the continent of Africa. The organization said in a statement that Africa will not reach a 70% vaccination rate until 2024, 2 years after the intended target. As of right now, two countries, Mauritius and Seychelles, have reached that 70% target. Greg, as we're hearing, Jen talk about South Korea and just the idea that boosters and vaccination rates in general have been kind of rocky all over, what are we seeing in different African nations about this, and what factors have made this so tough?
Right. The it's pretty sobering across the entire continent. We've been speaking about developed countries, Europe, the U.S., South Korea. And then we look at where Africa is as a continent, and it's deeply, deeply troubling as we look both at the current situation and the future. Only about 8% of Africa's population, and this is a population well over a billion people, who have received two full doses. And as you just noted, we could be 3 years away from getting a large number of Africans vaccinated. Now, we certainly owe South Africa a debt of gratitude for having a pretty good tracking system, identifying Omicron, sharing the information they had with the rest of the world to give everybody at least a little bit of a heads up. But it's also made clear how desperate the situation is in Africa. And again, you can't just sit back and say, oh, that's terrible for Africa. We really should do, see what we can do to help, or send sympathy and thoughts and prayers. As we've seen, it's taken less than a month for this variant, first detected in South Africa, to hit Britain hard, to hit the United States, other parts of Europe. It shows that this can come from anywhere. The beginning variant came from China. The second one came from India, and now from South Africa, and they're all spreading quicker and in larger numbers. So what we're seeing in Africa is a problem, and as large parts of the world remain unvaccinated, that seems to create conditions where we could see additional variants in the future.
For decades, Moscow and Beijing have held each other at arm's length, but things seem to be getting cozier between the two nations. Presidents Putin and Xi seem to enjoy each other's company for more than an hour and a half this week. Reports say they both gushed over plans to work on, quote, a new model of cooperation. David, what more do we know about what they had to say to each other? And is there a sense that this relationship is changing?
It's been changing for a few years. I mean, remember, it's only a few decades ago that these countries were on the brink of war. They were very suspicious of each other. And there's still a kind of lingering sense that these two neighbors don't fully trust each other. But the fact that both Russia and China find themselves under pressure from America and America's allies on a whole bunch of issues to do with human rights or their kind of, you know, any number of policies, they have found themselves in closer and closer alignment. And it's on the big stuff like, you know, China has Russia's back when it comes to being criticized over the occupation of Crimea. It's on the small stuff. So Vladimir Putin should, by rights, be a bit of a pariah at the upcoming Winter Olympics, which begin here in Beijing in February. Because remember, at the Winter Olympics in 2014 in Sochi, Russia was caught cheating. And it was the Russian state that was found guilty of a massive state-backed doping program to the extent that Russian athletes can't actually compete as Russian athletes under the Russian flag at these Olympics. And in fact, as a result, Vladimir Putin shouldn't be allowed to come to an international sporting event unless he gets an invitation from the head of state, which Xi Jinping has graciously offered. And that's even more remarkable because Xi Jinping, in the extremely tight zero COVID policy that we have here, Xi Jinping, the leader here, has not met another foreign leader for nearly 2 years. He simply does not meet foreigners. But we are told Vladimir Putin is going to be guest of honor at the Winter Olympics, and they are going to meet in person. And so they have a whole bunch of things they want to talk about, basically resisting the West, resisting America, and having each other's backs. So it's weapon sales, oil sales, gas sales, but also this geopolitical kind of partnership of two authoritarian strongmen who are pushing back against America and the idea that democracy has anything to criticize in a country like Russia or China.
Greg, to David's point, what extent could you argue that this call was neither entirely about China nor Russia, but was much more about the U.S. and how it's viewed as the leader of the free world?
Oh, absolutely. That's always the subtext when Putin and Xi get together. They both face these concerns with the United States on security issues. So you always have to think that that's going to be a factor. And we see two specific things that have been heating up, long-term issues that have been heating up. With China, it is a concern over Taiwan. We see that becoming an increasing point of friction. I can't tell you how much security officials have made that, U.S. security officials have made that their number one priority every time there's a conference or a discussion. Taiwan and how the U.S. should approach this is the number one issue. And then even more urgently, of course, is the Russian troop buildup on Ukraine's border. And Putin wants concessions there. He's threatening an invasion. Nobody knows for sure what he's doing. But with both of these countries, Russia and China, they're talking because of their concerns with the United States.
Greg, for NPR this week, you reported on President Putin's use of the military. I want to play this clip of one person you spoke with, Ben Hodges, who was the commander of the U.S. Army in Europe until he retired in 2017.
They haven't given up one inch. They've only continued to expand. Sometimes they use actual force. Sometimes they use the threat of force. And it seems like we are always on the back foot, that they always have the leverage. We are always responding to them.
Greg, in the context that Putin has again deployed thousands of troops to the border with Ukraine, is there a playbook, or is this just a seasoned mastermind who knows how to create instability when it suits him?
Little bit of both. Putin sent Russian forces to seize the Crimean Peninsula in 2014. It was quick. It was bloodless. That was very popular among many Russians. The Russians have also supported the separatists in eastern Ukraine. That took place the same year. That's been messy and bloody and a stalemate, and that's much less popular. So Putin has used the Russian military in Ukraine. Therefore, this buildup that we're seeing has to be taken seriously, and U.S. security officials are. It's also true that Putin has used military buildups on Russia's western border with other countries to try to win concessions, cases where he probably doesn't plan to invade, but he wants to win concessions. And we've seen that in literally just today. Russia's deputy foreign minister came out and offered in public very specific proposals saying that Russia wants in writing a formal sort of agreement that the U.S. and NATO will not expand into Ukraine, that the U.S. will and NATO will stop supporting Ukraine militarily. So the Russians sort of came out and formally said what they've been saying informally for a long time. But that's what makes it so hard to figure out what Putin is doing right now on the Ukrainian border. Is he likely to send troops into Ukraine? Or is he just trying to win concessions from the West? So it's a very dangerous game of chicken that we're seeing here.
David, what do we hear from China on all of this?
It's a really fascinating question, because in any other context with any other country, one of China's absolute horrors is countries getting their territorial integrity damaged. China is all about sovereignty, no interference in other countries, no nibbling away at another country's territory. So if China had any consistency, it would be condemning Russia for taking the Crimea, for threatening Ukraine. But of course, this alliance they have against the West pushes them quite close together. To Greg's point about what Putin wants, I think one of the most worrying things about the details that the deputy foreign minister of Russia outlines today is that some of the demands are designed, as far as we can tell, to be impossible for anyone in the West to accept. So he's not just talking about don't arm Ukraine, which you could imagine is a kind of question of how to keep Ukraine safe. Essentially, Vladimir Putin wants to undo 25 years of European integration. He says that any military infrastructure put into Eastern Central Europe since 1997 by NATO has to be taken out. So he's basically a man who has made it very clear that he has a grudge about how in those years after the fall of the Soviet Union, when Russia was weak and struggling with its own internal problems, Vladimir Putin's view is that that Russia was bullied and betrayed and lied to by a bullying West, which expanded NATO into the former Warsaw Pact, and he wants to undo that entire history. Now, he must know that's not doable. So what kind of fight does he really want to pick, not just with the Americans, but with allies in Europe who are keen to have a better relationship with Russia? But Vladimir Putin seems to be determined to make it as difficult as possible to do this in a kind of civilized way. So we just don't know where his brinksmanship in his mind is going to take him.
Jen, quickly, I wanted to get to one last story. This week, Germany expelled two Russian diplomats after a local judge in a murder trial said Moscow accusing it of state terrorism. Can you quickly tell us what this was about?
Sure. So this is about a 2019 killing of a man who's a Georgian citizen of Chechen ethnicity. He had previously been a fighter against Russian forces in Chechnya. He was basically executed in broad daylight in a central park in Berlin. The prosecutors in the case convicted the man for killing him, but they basically say that he is linked to Russian intelligence agencies, that this was carried out at the direction of the Russian state, and so that's why Germany is kicking out those diplomats and essentially saying that this is a violation of Germany's sovereignty. You can't carry out these kinds of brazen attacks on people in our country, and it's again coming in kind of the background against the backdrop of this broader tension that's going on over Ukraine. So it's definitely a big, kind of additional rift in the relationship.
Let's turn to something called the Uyghur Forced Labor Protection Act. This week, the Senate unanimously passed the bill. It punishes the Chinese government for its genocide of Uyghurs and other ethnic minorities. Earlier this week, it passed the House, and the White House says President Biden will sign this into law. Greg, can you explain what exactly this bill does?
Sure. So this would basically ban the import of goods from Western China, the Uyghur areas of Xinjiang, unless it can be proven that the products were not made with forced labor. And so, of course, the question is, well, what are they making that the U.S. might be importing? And the main thing, I think, is solar panels. China has been a big producer of them. A lot of them come from this area. So that's one thing we would see. But even more broadly, it points to this growing confrontation between the U.S. and China, and consensus is actually not dead in Washington. If you're Democrats and Republican and want to find common ground, just propose some punitive measures like this act, and very quickly you get agreement, and President Biden seems prepared to sign this bill.
This legislation was led by well-known Republican Senator Marco Rubio, who partnered with Democrat Jim McGovern in the House on this issue. Here's Senator Rubio making remarks about this on Wednesday.
I wish we didn't have to pass this bill, but we are a couple moves away from being able to send this to the White House for the president to sign and for it to become law. And I think it would be a powerful statement to make, but also impactful. A bill that says if you make things, if you are a company who makes things or sources material from these parts of China, you're going to have to prove that slaves didn't make it before you can bring it into this country. And I hope that if we can do that here, that other countries around the world will follow suit.
Jen, there was plenty of pushback to this bill from some very well-known U.S. companies. What exactly were their concerns?
Right. So actually, when the bill was kind of first introduced last year, there was a lot of kind of heavy lobbying by a number of multinational companies, some big names like Nike, Coca-Cola, even Apple. And their, you know, argument is essentially is that this is going to put, you know, an undue burden on their supply chains. You know, as Greg said, this is, you know, meant to, you know, if companies cannot clearly prove, you know, beyond a shadow of a doubt that there has been no forced labor used, they're not going to be able to import these products. And so the companies are essentially arguing that, you know, there's no way they can actually do that. It's really difficult, that they're already experiencing supply chain issues. You know, and it looks like that's not really going to fly. You know, I think human rights groups have been speaking up a lot. There are also, you know, people who are very hawkish on China in particular, like Marco Rubio, who have been pushing this. But I think, you know, on a more basic level, I think it's one thing to argue that this is difficult. And, you know, yes, you're making all these different products all around the world and it's hard to track your supply chains. But the bottom line is if you can't figure out whether you are literally using essentially slavery to, you know, make your Nike shoes or, you know, source your sugar for your Coca-Cola products, maybe you need to be doing a little bit more due diligence on your supply chains. You know, it seems like that would be a fairly basic thing for companies to be able to figure out. And so, you know, it looks like that their arguments didn't really win the day, and it is going to be this kind of more strict rules on these products. And I think we're going to start to see, you know, in addition to kind of cotton sourcing from Xinjiang, you know, Xinjiang is a huge cotton producing region. I think we're going to start to see much more, you know, serious activity by companies to start shifting their supply chains away from this region.
David, what signs have you seen, if any, that China's ruling Communist Party is starting to feel the squeeze from the West over how it's treating those in Xinjiang?
I don't think they're feeling an economic squeeze. And to slightly disagree with Jen about how easy it would be for companies to sort of know what's in their supply chain, this is precisely the problem. Because China is feeling immensely confident and is feeling very economically strong, it has a strong economy at the moment compared to others, and it's the indispensable place where a lot of stuff is made. So solar panels, 50% of the raw ingredient for solar panels comes from Xinjiang, 20% of the world's cotton from Xinjiang. They're basically banned international auditors from going in and checking supply chains. A lot of the big auditing companies will no longer do any business in Xinjiang because they get no access. And so you have China saying flatly, there is no forced labor. You can't come in. You can't audit. And yet they are this indispensable element. And it's not just in Xinjiang. One of the other problems is that there's stuff that isn't slavery, but it looks really coercive. So you have what the Chinese government calls surplus rural labor, which is basically poor small farmers from the Uyghur community who are shipped in large numbers across to the coastal provinces, and they are put into factories under what we think are pretty paramilitary conditions, very, very strict discipline. They're not free to come and go, but they're not slaves, and they're working in factories way away from Xinjiang, making stuff like shoes for Nike back in 2019. And that is genuinely a nightmare for multinationals because they can't do without the whole of China. But China's government is so angry and so self-confident at the moment that they are not willing to give a clean bill of health to supply chains that run across the whole of China, including through Xinjiang. So this is where the kind of the rubber hits the road. We are economically interdependent with a very, very unapologetic dictatorship. And that's unbelievably hard to manage. And we're at the beginning of that process.
David, there's another story The Economist has called the worst diplomatic crisis between China and a European state in decades. And you were there to see this unfold in Beijing. What country are we talking about?
So Lithuania, it's not a large country. It's fewer than 3 million people. But they are in a heap of trouble because they have been defying China in a bunch of ways. But most offensively from the position of the Chinese Communist Party, Lithuania has allowed the island of Taiwan, which of course the Chinese say is part of China and is not a country, to open a sort of quasi-embassy in Lithuania. As punishment for that, they downgraded, they said you don't have embassies anymore, you only have a chargé d'affaires office, and then they said that all of the diplomats remaining in Beijing from Lithuania had to hand in their identity cards on Tuesday of this week. And because it wasn't clear what was meant by that, whether they would still have diplomatic protection, when I was out on the pavements on Wednesday morning watching this kind of Cold War scene of every single Lithuanian diplomat and family member and a cat in a crate getting on this bus with secret policemen all around us watching. They weren't sure they were going to get out because they had to catch an Air China flight out. I was told I could not possibly write about this until the plane safely landed in Paris. You had friendly diplomats from other countries with their diplomatic number plate cars forming a kind of physical escort to get this bus to the airport in for fear that it might be prevented from leaving. And so this is like real Cold War stuff in the heart of modern Beijing, extraordinary degrees of punishment, basically to tell every other country, this is what happens if you cross China's red lines on Taiwan. But it is a real wave of shock among diplomats here in Beijing.
Let's move to Afghanistan. The United Nations humanitarian chief said that country is in urgent need and its economic collapse is, quote, happening before our eyes. Greg, the Taliban took over Kabul in August of this year. How much does that have to do with where we are at now?
Oh, it has a lot to do with it. A lot of the somewhere around 75-80% of the Afghan government budget came from foreign sources, mostly the U.S. and the West. So that money's not going in to pay salaries, and a lot of people had government jobs and were dependent on that. A lot of aid groups pulled out. When the U.S. military and allied forces pulled out, not only did the militaries pull out, but the embassies closed down. A lot of aid groups pulled out. Businesses stopped operating or couldn't send in supplies and material. Exports have been difficult, imports and exports. So all of this is very directly related to the Taliban. Now, that said, Afghanistan is always a poor country. Winter is harsh there, and the country needed support even when the U.S. was there and very active. So the fact that now all that is gone creates this very difficult situation where should the U.S., the West, and others give money, food, medicine that will perhaps be controlled to some degree by the Taliban. Again, a lot of the organizations that were working there are no longer there to do distribution. So on the one hand, the Afghans face this terrible, terrible winter and absolutely need this humanitarian support. On the other hand, there's some reluctance to do it or where to draw the line where you don't want the Taliban getting money to use simply as they see fit.
Right. And at the same time, all of this is happening economically. The BBC is reporting that there's a booming drug trade, including meth and heroin, under Taliban rule.
We're driving through a bazaar where opium is being sold openly. Much of it is then going to be processed into heroin. The Taliban are not stopping drug production. In fact, they've been taxing it for years, but they don't want journalists seeing it being traded. That's why we're filming from inside the car.
David, the Taliban's not denying that it's allowing this trade to flourish right now, but where is this ranking when you're thinking about priorities for the country's Islamic rulers, given everything else we've been talking about?
Well, if you want a clue, you can look at how they ran the country the first time around. If you remember, 20 years ago, they had a turn of running Afghanistan, and they did eventually, after some years, ban the drugs trade. But in the meantime, when they were an insurgency not running the country, they were taxing drugs production and drug smuggling as a major source of revenue. And right now, the Taliban's position is, yes, we know that you don't like this, but if the world doesn't want Afghanistan producing heroin, but now also very large amounts of crystal meth, amphetamine, then you need to pay us, basically. He's had a Taliban spokesman tell the BBC, BBC amazing reporting that they were doing there, Taliban spokesman saying, you know, if you don't like this, the world should help. And so it's basically a kind of a protection racket if you don't want these drugs being produced. And there's a genuine problem, too, which is that these farmers, you know, during the entire period of 20 years when America was pouring in billions and billions of dollars in aid, there were any number of schemes to say, let's give them drip irrigation so they can grow tomatoes or okra or grapes and raisins. But just nothing makes as much money as opium poppies. And now this other herb, ephedra, which you can produce ephedrine from, which is how you get crystal meth. And so it's just unbelievably profitable in a place with a lot of very poor people and a government that doesn't really care if there's horror on the streets of the West because they don't like the West very much. So it is an absolute nightmare for the rest of the world as they work out how to stop Afghanistan from sliding into a failed narco state.
Finally this week, France has joined a growing number of countries moving to ban so-called conversion therapy. The French Parliament voted Tuesday to outlaw the practice and is now waiting on a signature from French President Emmanuel Macron. Canada outlawed conversion therapy last week. Jen, before we go any further, can you remind us what conversion therapy is and how widespread this is worldwide?
Yeah, absolutely. So it's essentially the kind of most general definition. It is any practice or treatment or service that's designed to either change or to repress a person's sexual orientation, their gender identity, or their gender expression. So it can really kind of run the gamut of any sort of, you know, more traditional kind of accepted therapy techniques like talk therapy to very much more extreme things, you know, hypnosis, even shock therapy has been used. And essentially, it's treating LGBTQ identity, gender expression, sexual orientation as a pathology, as you know, a sickness that needs a cure. And that is what these bills are meant to stop. They're meant to make it illegal. And one in Canada makes it illegal to provide, promote, and profit off of these therapies. And, you know, it has been used widespread, you know, around the world. You see a lot of, in particular, religious-related groups promoting this kind of therapy. But there is a growing movement internationally to start, in particular in Europe, to start outlawing it. And we've seen several states in the U.S. do the same thing. So I think it's definitely a positive that it is moving, you know, towards banning this practice. But I think there's definitely a lot more room for legislation to improve in many places where this is still in practice. And, you know, more generally, the LGBTQ identities and orientations are treated as a pathology rather than, you know, nature.
In fact, it's about 20 U.S. states where this practice is banned. Does this add momentum to have the U.S. move forward with a nationwide ban?
I think there's definitely, you know, I think activists are definitely feeling this, feeling like this is a win in Canada and in France, and there's definitely going to be movement toward that. Whether we are going to see this as a legislative priority in the Biden administration, however, I would hazard a guess, probably not, given that they're, you know, struggling with their kind of big landmark legislation right now to even get that through. But it's definitely giving momentum to the kind of broader movement, certainly.
Okay, we're almost out of time, but I wonder if we can just go around quickly and tell, if you can tell me one story, one last story that we haven't talked about yet that you wanted to mention. Greg Myrie, what else have you been keeping an eye on this week?
Boy, you really caught me on that one. I'm going to have to take a hard pass on that. You've hit all the ones I've been looking at.
All right, David Rennie.
Well, just to get back to Omicron, we have the Winter Olympics coming very soon. There's going to be tens of thousands of foreigners arriving in a China that is absolutely determined to have no cases at all. There's been lockdown tight for 2 years. That is going to be a gigantic, gigantic challenge. And we're going to see, you know, unbelievable controls and restrictions that are going to make it even weirder living here than usual.
Jen, what about you?
I'm watching very closely the shellacking that Boris Johnson's party just got. This North Shropshire by-election, the Lib Dem candidate won, and his party, Boris Johnson's party, is not really looking like they're super thrilled right now. And he, you know, he's definitely not necessarily at risk right this second of losing his job, but they're definitely going to be pushing for some changes. So that's something that I think everyone, especially UK watchers, are going to be watching very closely in the coming weeks and months.
Yes, we will be keeping an eye on that as well. My thanks for this week go to Jennifer Williams. Jen is deputy editor at Foreign Policy and host of the podcast, The Negotiators. Greg Myrie, NPR's national security correspondent, and not for the first time staying up late for us from the Chinese capital, David Rennie, Beijing bureau chief for The Economist. Thanks to you all. 1A's audio engineer and sound designer is Mike Kidd. Barb Anguiano looks after the 1A podcast. It's where you'll find all of our best guests in conversation. 1A senior producer is Jonquilin Hill. Our managing producer is Paige Osborne. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of the American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Nyla Boodoo from Axios Today. This is 1A.